Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Matthew LeClaire, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought. On this show, we promote and defend the values of humanism, which includes critical thinking, rationality, and scientific naturalism, which we utilize in our constant efforts to create positive social change. Today, our guest is Bill McKibben, a widely recognized leading environmental author, journalist, and activist. Mr. McKibben's many books include New York Times bestsellers The End of Nature and Earth, as well as Deep Economy, The Age of Missing Information, and his new book coming out this Tuesday, September 17th, Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. He is also the founder of the grassroots climate campaign, 350.org. It was very difficult to arrange this interview with Mr. McKibben because his schedule is so hectic. Since I only had approximately 30 minutes with him, we will start today's show with a clip from one of our previous shows, which will tie in perfectly to my interview with Mr. McKibben. The following clip is from an interview Barry Seidman and I conducted with Naomi Oreskes and Joel Cavell on the book Merchants of Doubt. Here, we discuss the politics of science denial.
So, Naomi Oreskes, in your book with Eric, how do you see the use of the word doubt in the areas you talk about, and who are those who are fostering this doubt?
Well, it's exactly as you just said. Essentially, what these folks are doing is turning doubt on its head. So in normal scientific inquiry, in normal life, doubt, healthy skepticism, curiosity are good things. They're the things that drive scientific inquiry. So doubt and skepticism are essential to all scientific research, to all research in general. But what these folks do, and as you said, it's the same strategy that's used often in the discussions about evolution and creationism, is to kind of foster sort of malignant doubt, a kind of corrosive doubt that nothing, that we really don't know anything, that everything's uncertain, cherry-picking the data, nitpicking little tiny details that don't seem to fit in or misrepresenting information in order to create an impression that we really don't know, that the whole matter is really up for grabs, and therefore, well, in the case of creationism, the argument is that we should be, you know, quote, teaching the both sides or teaching the controversy because the scientific knowledge is insecure. And in the cases that we look at in our story, which is a whole set of different environmental issues, starting with tobacco and culminating in global warming, to argue that because we don't really know for sure, it wouldn't make any sense to take action on these issues like having an emissions trading system or a carbon tax.
Would you consider the quote-unquote science used by the people who foster this doubt, and we'll get into who they are and more details of your book in a minute. Would you consider this pseudoscience or junk science? And if so, how can ordinary Americans differentiate between junk or pseudoscience and a genuine article?
Crucial question. So first of all, I don't use the phrase junk science or pseudoscience for two reasons, Okay. Because this isn't any kind of science at all. It's not junk science, it's not pseudoscience, it's not bad science, it isn't science. It's really politics, and that's really the whole argument about this book. This is a political debate being dressed up as science, and it's being dressed up as science because most of us are interested in science. Most people are curious about science, and they want to learn about it, and if they think it's a scientific debate, then they have a very different reaction to it than if they think it's a political debate. And so the whole argument of our book, what we try to explain in the book, this is not a scientific debate. This has never been a scientific debate. This debate was born political, and that's what we try to show in the book.
Can you expand, then, on the various ways these scientists or political operatives, as it may be, operate in their creation of what it really amounts to pseudo-information, false information, and how they've managed to...
Right, it's really disinformation.
Right, disinformation,
exactly.
And how they've managed to convince, you know, scores of Americans to doubt what most other scientists find plenty of evidence for. You can start here maybe with the tobacco industry and that story, which is the first in your book, because it's kind of where historically we find this beginning.
Exactly. So what we do in the book really, and I think many listeners of your program will not be entirely shocked by the story we tell in the book, but it really explains it, and we think it explains it in a way that hasn't been explained before. So what we've shown in the book is that this entire story really begins with tobacco. It begins in the 1950s. In fact, it even begins on a specific day in 1953 when the scientific evidence regarding the harms of tobacco was becoming well known, and some fairly significant experiments had taken place, particularly one particular experiment, the Sloan-Kettering Foundation, which was broadly taken to be a kind of definitive demonstration that tars in tobacco cause cancer in laboratory mice. And the tobacco industry was very, very upset by this work and realized that it was very, very damaging for them. And so they didn't know what to do. And so a group of tobacco executives met in New York City at the Plaza Hotel, where they didn't accept women in those days, and actually decided to engage in a project to challenge the scientific evidence, to fight science with science, and to claim that the science wasn't really settled, and therefore it would be inappropriate for government to tell our citizens whether or not we should smoke cigarettes. So it begins there, and then as we show in the book, it spreads. And a key part of the spread is the recruitment of scientists. So as I said, the story is not, it's not a scientific debate, but it does involve science, and it involves scientists. And so what the tobacco industry recognized early on was that if they, the executives, the vice presidents and CEOs and folks, they said that tobacco was good for us, most of us wouldn't be so credulous as to believe that. But if they could recruit scientists to say it, then that would be a different matter. We as open-minded, sensible American people, we would want to hear what those scientists had to say. So in a sense, the strategy depends upon our open-mindedness as citizens. It depends on a good quality about Americans. We are generally open-minded people, and it exploits it. And it also exploits the credibility of journalists, because, again, journalists wouldn't be so stupid as to think that the president of Philip Morris, or the CEO of British American Tobacco, journalists wouldn't be so stupid as to think that those people were exactly objective.
Right.
But if a distinguished scientist said it, that would be a different matter. And so a big part of the strategy was to recruit scientists to speak to the press, to speak to the American people. But the crucial thing, and this is, you know, you said, how's the sensible person to tell the difference? What we point out in the book is that if you just ask a simple question, what were these people actually experts in, what you see is that they were not actually cancer experts. In most cases, they weren't even medical doctors or biologists. One of the key people we track in our story was a famous solid-state physicist. So he'd never done research on tobacco. He'd never done research in epidemiology or oncology or public health. But the press didn't really ask any questions. They didn't dig. They didn't say, well, what do you actually know about cancer? What research have you actually done in this area? They just saw a man who was a distinguished scientist who had scientific credentials, who had the letters PhD after his name, and they didn't really ask the follow-up question that they should have asked, which was, what was that PhD in?
Right. And this may seem like a fairly obvious question to a lot of people, but perhaps not. So do you know some of who these scientists were that were going on board with this, and also why they would choose to go along with these sort of imitation findings that really didn't really have good evidence to prove that, you know, it wasn't dangerous, but determined that anyway? Who were they, and why would they go along with this?
Yeah, we know who they are. I mean, that's in a sense, that was the whole point of the research we did, was
right.
to answer that question, to say, who were these people, and why did they do what they did?
Right.
And so, as you can imagine, our whole manuscript was read 3 times by a lawyer to make sure that everything we said was documented, was factual, you know, that it's all, everything is factual, and it's all documented with footnotes and documentary evidence. So the key people in the story were a group of scientists who had come to positions of power, prestige, and influence during the Cold War, and in some cases even in World War II. And these were men who had worked on weapons and rocketry programs. So they'd worked on hydrogen bomb, they'd worked on the atomic bomb, they'd worked in the early years of the space program, they'd worked with the Navy on submarine acoustic detection during the Cold War. So they were very brilliant people, very successful. And because of the work they had done in World War II and the Cold War, they became very influential and served on many government policy advisory committees. And so these were men who, in some cases, were on first names basis with the President of the United States. So very powerful, very influential, and very smart. And one of them, a man by the name of Frederick Seitz, began work with the tobacco industry in the late 1970s. So they're scientists, so they know what science is. They know the difference between good science, bad science, or science and politics. They are smart. So it's not credible that they don't understand the data. They understand the scientific peer review process, so they know the difference between true research and disinformation. So why would they do this? And the story we tell in the book is essentially a story about their own politics that were born in the Cold War. So what these men all have in common is they were all deeply, deeply communist. Anti-communist.
Right.
Deeply, deeply anti-communist. Very, very hawkish. Very committed to a very powerful, muscular military and the role of science and technology in defending the United States against the communist threat. And I think it's fair to say that their whole identity as men, as individuals, was really tied to the belief that what they had done was crucial for protecting the United States from the Soviet threat, from the Red Menace. And I think they believe that authentically.
Yeah, even if the means going about it wasn't necessarily the best, you get the impression that they did it for a reason that they thought was good. They thought they were doing something for the public good.
Exactly, and that's in a way the only thing that can make sense of this story, because otherwise they just would be, they would just be evil. And I don't think it's not that simple. I mean, they end up doing things which are really disgraceful, but I think they understand in their own minds, in terms of, as you said, doing things for the public good. So protecting the public against the Red Threat. But what you see happening in the story is a strange twist right around the time that the Cold War ends. So in 1989, the Berlin Wall comes down, and these gentlemen are fairly mature by this point, and several of them are actually retired. So you might have thought that they'd just be happy that they had that the West had won the Cold War, and that what they had worked for had come to the conclusion that they themselves had hoped for, but they don't. It's like they're sort of addicted to the fight. They're like generals, can't put down their arms and keep fighting in the last war. They begin to attack environmentalists, who they accuse of being watermelons, green on the outside but red on the inside. They start seeing red under the beds in all these different environmental movements. They start arguing that environmentalists are really socialist, that they're exaggerating the environmental threat for a political agenda, and that political agenda is to bring communism in through the back door, so that having won the Cold War, we would actually, in the long run, actually still lose through this backdoor mechanism of excessive government intervention, excess regulation. And that's the piece that kind of, once you get it, then you really get it. Then you see it everywhere. It took a while for Eric Conway and I to figure this piece of the story out. But once we started reading what some of these folks had written in conservative, libertarian, and right-wing locations, things like the Proceedings, the Journal of the Cato Institute, for example, you begin to see this language in a lot of places, and you begin to see this accusation. And now, you see it in politics all over the place. Just the other day, Newt Gingrich said that climate change is just the latest attempt by the left to control our lives.
Right.
So this idea that the left is really trying to control us, and these are just excuses to expand government control. It's that kind of Cold War anxiety that continues to run through this whole story right up to the present day.
Before we get to my interview with Mr. McKibben, I'd like to read from his upcoming book, Oil and Honey. I found the mountains surrounding Lake Champlain as a fairly young man. I'd moved to the Adirondacks at the age of 26, falling in love with the sheer wildness of the place. A bigger tract of protected land than Glacier, the Grand Canyon, the Yellowstone, and Yosemite combined. A child of the suburbs, I was knocked over by the contact with hot, cold, wet. It was no different than any other incandescent young love, except that it has burned on for years. Hemlock bowing across the stream, red pine needles baking in the August sun high on the ridge, coyotes yipping in the night. Sky so black the Milky Way stretches to each horizon. All of it was a revelation. In fact, the dominant emotion of the end of nature was not fear, but sadness, a lament for the wildness that climate change threatened to leech away. Just to say the names calms me down. Ampersand Mountain, 13th Lake, Raquette River. After 15 years, my wife and daughter and I moved 50 miles across the lake to Vermont, sacrificing a little of the wildness for the strong sense of community that defines the Green Mountain State. The town meeting, the farmer's market, the microbrewery. These are the places that might be made to work. The Adirondacks is the best example of a wilderness with people living in and among it. Vermont, the best example of an earlier American state of mind, before the hyper-individualism of the TV age completely took over. There's so much to be done here at home. You can sense the new world coming into embryonic form with its own sources of everything, from seeds to capital. And for me, even more, it's the landscape that fits with a jigsaw precision into the hole in my heart. I'm happy when I'm home,
when I could see the sun shining through the winter bare ridge at dusk, when I could swat the black flies come June. My 30s were essentially an extended early retirement. I spent those years, the 1990s, writing and wandering and watching my daughter grow. Her first word was birch, which pleased me more than I can say. By the time she was 15, she'd climbed all 46 of the high peaks in her native Adirondacks, which made me at least as proud as her college admissions letter did a few years later. Which is why it's so odd that I've spent more nights away than home these past years. I've been to every continent since 2008, and once I hit four of them in 6 days. At 350.org, we've organized, in the words of Outside Magazine, quote, more rallies than Lenin and Gandhi and Martin Luther King combined. It's been the most satisfying work of my life, endlessly difficult and endlessly interesting. But asleep in some Days Inn or Courtyard by Marriott, I dreamed of the Champlain Valley, with the Adirondacks towering to the west and its growing web of organic dairies and community-supported agriculture farms. I woke up to eat at the breakfast bar, non-Vermont, non-maple syrup, and do rhetorical battle with retrograde congressmen. But I did that battle in the name of my place, remembering what it felt like. I could try to imagine unborn generations and the suffering poor, and the other huge reasons to fight climate change. But I never had the slightest trouble conjuring up the tang of the first frosty morning in the Adirondack fall. The evening breeze that stirs as the sun drops below the ridge. So when I say activism didn't come naturally to me, it's not simply because I'm a writer. It's because the need to stay close to home was very nearly biological. If I missed a week wandering in the woods, it meant not seeing those flowers that year. The trillium would have to wait till next spring. But I'd turned 50, and the next springs were now fewer than the springs I'd known. At night, on the road, distracted by worry, I'd say those names. Camel's Hump, Breadloaf Mountain, Otter Creek. I'm a mediocre meditator, but the one mantra that could lull me to sleep in some lonely Hilton was the list of Lake Champlain's many tributaries, north to south along the Vermont shore, then back down at the New York side. It hurt, physically, to leave. Flying back into Burlington Airport, winging past Whiteface and Giant Mountain, wheeling over Missisquoi Bay, calmed me down like nothing else. That the two sides of my life were so at odds bothered me to no end, far more than the jet fuel my travels burned. I couldn't quite make them connect. And now, my interview with Mr. McKibben. So thanks so much for coming on the show today, Mr. McKibben. It's great to have you on and finally get the opportunity to talk with you.
It's a real pleasure to be with you, Matt.
So this may seem like a very strange place to begin, but considering the title of your upcoming book, Oil and Honey, I wanted to begin with some of your personal connections to bees. Now, I understand that you were stung by dozens of bees at one particular time, and of course that would drive most people away from them. But in your book, you describe how you actually interacted with them, and often, for me personally, I don't know if I could ever face them again. I always have a difficult time approaching them as it stands now, and I've never been stung. So,
it was actually, yes, it's a very good point. I kicked over in the woods years ago in the Adirondacks, and that's actually not a bees, of yellow jackets. And I got stung, I think by the time my wife got me to the hospital and they counted, I think we had 78 stings or something. And so I had developed at that point a deep prejudice against all things that both fly and stink. And so it was a little unlikely to be spending a lot of time with bees. But I deeply admired this character, Kirk Webster, this wonderful apiarist, beekeeper in the Champlain Valley. And I thought that his sort of approach to the world was profound and interesting, and that he was a remarkable figure. And so I wanted to know about his work. And the first few times, but I stayed away from the bees. I would just sort of get to know him and things. And I'd spend more time with him in the winter when there aren't bees flying around.
Right.
But he finally gave me this bee suit to wear. The kind that beekeepers wear. You've seen them kind of white with a veil and things.
Right.
But most beekeepers aren't completely terrified of bees, and so they wear them kind of casually. They'll put on the veil. They'll maybe wear the gloves, maybe not. Depends what kind of mood the bee's in, because bees, the mood of the hive changes dramatically with the weather, with the conditions in the, you know, in the flowers and things like that. I put on this suit like I was, you know, getting ready to go, you know, deep sea diving. And this was my, you know, I battened down every hatch and velcroed every cuff. And,
right.
And then you really are pretty close to impermeable. I got stung a couple of times kind of through the fabric, but, and actually swelled up fairly well, but because I'm clearly reactive to this stuff, but never got stung by a bunch of bees at once. It was interesting to watch Kirk. Clearly beekeepers get stung too, and he'd get stung three or four times a day probably.
Wow.
And he had just, you know, attuned himself to the pain, and it wasn't the problem. One of the things that was fascinating for me was to find out that there's a fairly large subculture of people with bad arthritis who get relief from being stung. The venom does something useful to, I mean, I don't know what it, whether it's a, you know, I don't know the physiology, but it's a kind of small but interesting side market in supplying bees to people to put on their joints to sting them.
Hmm.
So it's a very, the relationship with bees and that the stings is a kind of complicated and interesting one.
So what is the relationship then between the climate change fight that you've been working on for so long and your story of bees? Because your book that's coming out this Tuesday, Oil and Honey, is, you talk about both, and you use the bees as a jumping off point at many points in the book. So why did you choose that?
Well, there's several reasons, I think. One is that I was spending a lot of time movement building, and the bees are a kind of interesting metaphor for the kind of movement that we're building. It's not, the queen bee turns out to be not that absolutely central a figure in the operation of the hive. She basically lays eggs, you know.
That's about it.
Lies there. The hive itself is a kind of organism, and it runs with remarkable kind of self-organizing principle almost. That scientists don't understand completely, but they're understanding more and more about all the time. I think that the movement, this climate movement we've been building, is a fascinating movement in the same way. It's largely leaderless, or maybe another way of saying it would be leaderful. It's different than the kind of social movements we've been used to in a way in the past. And the bees helped me think about that a little bit. That we don't need, I mean, we don't have a kind of Martin Luther King figure. And that's either it might be a bad thing, it might be a good thing, it just is the thing. And I think that probably it's actually really healthy. We're taking on the fossil fuel industry, which is this sprawling protean creature, the most central backbone of our economy. The biggest, richest force there ever was. And so a kind of frontal assault but led by some, charismatic figure is probably bound to be a sort of doomed assault. We need a kind of equally protean, sprawling, relentless, on all fronts, in every place, but coordinated effort on these guys. And boy, the efforts of millions of bees in a hive or in a bee yard to produce honey one grain at a time is a reasonable metaphor. The other reason that I wanted to write about them was that I've always thought that there's both a local and a global dimension to this fight. And this allowed me to kind of put that in words. We have to adapt and our local communities, economies, societies, cities, civilizations to be far more self-reliant and resilient than they are at the moment. we're not going to be able to depend, since we have to get off fossil fuel for reasons to do with climate change, we're not going to be able to depend on the kind of endless supply lines to every corner of the earth that have marked the last century. And since we've already done some damage by changing the climate, we're going to have to be able to prepare and adapt in our local communities to do that. So I'm fascinated and always have been by the ways that we're beginning to build these working local economies. Vermont, where I live, is a pretty good example, and the local food thing is a beautiful thing. At the same time, there are deep limits to the level of adaptation that any place can deal with. And so we're also going to have to do this global movement to prevent change on a scale that we can't adapt to. What I'm saying is we've raised the temperature 1 degree so far, and we're probably going to raise it another degree even if we do everything right. That means that every place is going to have to adapt to that and adapt in significant ways, New York City included, you know. Some of that adaptation will be physical, you know. We're going to have to build walls out at the Verrazano Narrows or whatever to try and keep the sea from inundating. And a lot of it's going to have to be social. We're going to have to figure out how to protect people, how not to have kind of insane divisions and inequalities that manifested. We have to do that, and at the same time, we're going to have to keep the temperature from going up 4 or 5 degrees, which is what will happen if we just keep burning fossil fuel. If the temperature goes up 4 or 5 degrees, then the changes on this planet will be so big that there'll be no adaptation. Mm. It won't make any difference.
Well, these seem to be the kind of issues that you talked about over 2 decades ago in your first book, The End of Nature. When you wrote that book, did you suspect that 20-plus years later, we would have taken more serious action in that time to make sure that we didn't get to this point of changing the climate in such a serious way? Or did you already sort of envision that we would actually push ourselves sort of beyond the brink of disaster before those necessary changes were made?
That's a very good question. And, you know, at the time I wrote The End of Nature, I was pretty young. And so on the one hand, I was, you know, grim in certain ways. I mean, the book's called The End of Nature.
Right.
On the other hand, I was certain that we'd make some kind of effort as a civilization to do something about it. And the fact that we haven't made any kind of serious effort, either as a country or a civilization, to do anything about it is depressing to me. It's, what I thought and what I think most of the people I knew thought was, look, the scientists have alerted us to what's going on. And they've gone up to Capitol Hill year after year and explained that the worst thing that ever happened is in the process of happening. So, you know, rational systems will react rationally, begin to do something about this. And I fear that in many ways, my, the lesson of those 25 years is the lesson that our systems are not all that rational, really. That they react not to reason, but to power. And that so far, the power of the fossil fuel industry has been sufficient to prevent a real reaction. That if that continues, we're in a lot of literal hell.
For those of you just tuning in, my name is Matthew LeClaire, and you're listening to Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. My guest today is Bill McKibben, a leading environmental author, journalist, and activist.
Now the goal is to build a countervailing power. It can't be money power. We're never going to have as much money as Exxon. Exxon made more money last year than any company in the history of money. So the goal has to be instead to find a different currency to work in. And those are the currencies, you know, familiar to BAI listeners, you know, the currencies of movements, passion, spirit, creativity. That's what we've been trying to do across this movement. And the part of it that a few of us helped start, 350.org, has been a part of that. And had a kind of particular sort of open source approach to it that I think is, as I said, useful because we have to build such a sprawling movement to have any hope of success.
What do you
the big environmental groups are wonderful. They've done great things. We love working with them, but they're not scaled to take on. They're scaled to, you know, help preserve the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. They're not scaled to take on the fossil fuel industry. And if we're going to take it on, it's going to have to be not just environmentalists. It's going to have to be much, much, much broader progressive coalition. It's very exciting to see that forming. Very exciting to see people like Naomi Klein or the, you know, Indigenous Environmental Network or all these, you know, sort of people who come from somewhat different parts of this thing than the Sierra Club or something. See them all working together toward common purpose. That's why the fight over the Keystone Pipeline has been so exciting.
Yeah, and that's something I wanted to talk about. I have it later here in my list of many, many questions, which I know we would never have time for, no matter how long we had to for an interview. But why don't you tell us just a little bit about the Keystone XL pipeline, why it is such a problem, and where the controversy currently stands in terms of how close it is to going forward.
Okay, I'll do my best.
30 seconds, go ahead.
The pipeline is important because, it's important for many reasons. It could spill disastrously. It takes land from people. It places ends in Port Arthur, Texas, with the classic textbook case of environmental injustice already. But the biggest reason that it's important is that there's an unbelievable amount of carbon up in Canada. The NASA scientist James Hansen, your fellow New Yorker, said a couple of years ago, look, there's enough carbon up there that if we burn it all, it's game over for the climate up in the tar sands in Canada where this pipeline would begin. So shutting down the pipeline, it's a way to stop the expansion of those tar sands and to keep some of that dirty oil on the ground. It won't by itself solve climate change, but it's a useful step along the way. It also has become a powerful symbol. Because the president himself will make the decision on this. There's an old and somewhat obscure law that requires the president personally to approve any piece of infrastructure that crosses the national border. Because of that, President Obama's on the hook here. And not Congress, not John Boehner, not Mitch McConnell, not anybody else. And so the president, if he blocks his pipeline, will have become the first world leader to have said, here's something big we're not going to build because of its effect on the climate. And if he does that, it will be a very powerful step. It will be, it'll be a way, among other things, to reopen the international consideration of climate that foundered so disastrously at Copenhagen in 2009. We've got to get, they don't call it global warming for nothing. We've got to get everybody involved. And a gesture from the United States would be the most important single thing that could happen to make that happen. We seem to understand this, or at least the president seems to insist on it in other realms, you know. It's absolutely important and imperative that America be the one to draw the line against Syria, you know, and at the, you know, cost of going and dropping a lot of bombs on them. Well, it's, 100 times more important for us to be the ones that draw the line against carbon in the atmosphere because we put most of it there. If CO2 is undoubtedly the kind of most dangerous gas in the world at this point, and we're responsible for the bulk of it in the atmosphere at the moment because we've been pumping it out for so long, we need actually some leadership finally from the president, and we'll find out if we're going to get it or whether he's just a fraud on this and talks to contain them in the end and for the will of oil companies. If he does, if he does the wrong thing, it'll be depressing, but I guess it'll help us focus the movement even more clearly on the fossil fuel industry. Mm. As you know, we're also running this sort of huge campaign try and get people to divest their financial holdings in that industry, precisely because we need to lessen the power, their ability to exert influence over the president, over the Congress, over the, you know, the Central Committee in Beijing, over everybody.
You know, I actually attend Columbia University, and I'm trying to pursue an MA in science journalism, so this fits in quite well with a lot of the stuff that I'm working on. But when I heard about the divestment idea, I started to look into it just to see, you know, what is Columbia University doing about this? Have they considered it? And I saw that you actually gave a talk, I think a couple months ago, over at Columbia, and you briefly talked about this. With institutions that have such an enormous endowment and such incredible influence, it seems that they're not necessarily going to go along with this idea because they have currently so much invested in the fossil fuel industry
they're not going to go along with it easily.
Yeah, that's what it seems. So, and I noticed
your predecessors at Columbia a quarter century ago tried to use this same tactic when the question was apartheid in South Africa. And when Columbia and every other university had extensive holdings in companies that did business with that apartheid regime. And it did not happen easily, and it won't happen easily here. It took 4 or 5 years of serious, serious organizing to get a lot of schools, including Columbia and Barnard, to do the right thing. You know, some schools never did. Harvard never really. They only sold a little bit of their holding. They never really divested. So it's going to take serious, serious organizing, and we'll see if, you know, your generation is capable of doing that the way your predecessors did. It's happening elsewhere too. 15 or 16 big cities now have divested, several big religious denominations. In its early days, the momentum's pretty good already, but it's, make no mistake, you know, if you're the fossil fuel industry, you're going to defend your turf with everything you've got because it's profitable turf. You know, the amount of money they're making is beyond belief.
Oh yeah, of course, and they're making that money at least right now. But one thing that I can't really understand is why they wouldn't want to take some of that enormous amount of money that they have and start working on alternative technology that they themselves can eventually continue to profit on, because they must know that they're going to run out.
That's a very good question, and I think the reason goes like this. You know, they took a little bit of money 10 years ago, and you know, a couple of them, BP, put 2 or 3% of their research budget into sun and wind. They've sold off all those things now, and they're concentrating all of them on hydrocarbons because they're making so much money and because they really came to understand what a threat to their business model renewable energy is. So let's say you're Exxon, and let's say you're thinking about solar power, okay? It's true. You can make some money, maybe a lot of money, putting up solar panels on roofs all across America. It would be a huge economic transformation, on and on and on. But the problem from Exxon's point of view with a solar panel is you can't meter the sun. Once it's up there, you know, you get free power from it.
Right.
And to them, that really sucks. That's the worst possible business model you can imagine. Why would you give away for free the commodity energy that you've been, you know, built the greatest fortune on earth, controlling the scarcity of?
I noticed that a lot of your book talks about your transition, I guess we can call it, from author to activism. You seem to be relatively reluctant in that transformation, mostly because it seemed to me that you have a very strong connection to home. Particularly, you talk an awful lot about Vermont and how much you enjoy nature, and you seem to be very connected to living simply. And also, just to, in general, it in many of your speeches and many of the ways that you interact with people, you do not seem to be extreme in temperament either. And that doesn't jive so well typically with activism. So I'd love for you to just talk us through a little bit your experience and some parts of your transition from author to activist, how that came about and why it was so important for you to make that change, even if you weren't 100% excited to do it at first.
So the most important thing for me was the realization that we needed some kind of movement. And I didn't really know how to build it, but I had the great advantage of being, and this was unlikely, but of being at Middlebury College in Vermont, where I teach a little bit. And at the moment when 7 students were there together who, while they were in college, were doing remarkable organizing on campus and in the state and really even a little bit nationally about climate change. They were all friends, and they were remarkable, remarkable organizers. And I was watching them, and it was like, you know, they were getting ready to go off and graduate and go out into the world. And I knew they'd keep working on good things, but, you know, it was going to be there. It was like watching if you liked basketball or something, watching a collection of suddenly, you know, 7 people who were 7 feet tall walked into the room, you know. Your thought would be, huh, this should be a basketball team. It's been such a privilege to watch them develop 350.org, this thing we founded, into a really sort of sprawling new kind of movement. They're now, you know, they were 21 and 22 when I first met them. They're now 28 and 29. They're running everything. Their main office is in Brooklyn, in Dumbo. They're fantastic at it. And when I say that, I mean, they went and the first year they were there, for the first big global day of action we had, they organized, they didn't organize, they coordinated 5,200 rallies in 181 countries. Mm-hmm. They pioneered a new kind of organizing. And it's been really a good fun and a privilege to get to watch that spread and to get to help that spread. Now, they don't need me anywhere near as much anymore if they ever did for that. And so you're right. I want to subside back into my place and back into my real role in the world, which is as a writer. And I look forward to more and more of that in the future.
I could even see it in a lot of your writing that you have this type of connection to nature and almost, I would say, to peace. And I wonder if you think, with all of the different events that are coming up, I know that you have an event, I think, on September 21st to draw the line against the Keystone Pipeline. I know that there are a number of things that you guys are working on now. How do you keep yourself continuing this fight day after day when the opposition is not only so powerful, but in many respects, so rotten? And the reason I say rotten is because I'm thinking, for example, about one thing you talked about in the book, which was a sign that was put up, I believe, by the Heartland Institute, though I could be wrong, with that Ted Kaczynski quote, you know, I believe in global warming. Do you? You know, and it just seems like one of those things where you're fighting this battle day in and day out. And I understand that you're traveling many times, you're taking multiple flights throughout a day and continuing this fight, but the opposition seems so goofy and unwilling to listen that I wonder how you keep yourself going.
That's actually the very right question on which to end before I have to go off and give a talk. That day that the Heartland Institute put up that billboard and tried to make the case that everybody who cared about global warming was a mass murderer or something.
Right.
It was kind of dumb, but it was, you know, typical of that kind of stuff. It just so happened that day 350.org had organized a global day of action called Connect the Dots, where we asked people in places all over the world who had experienced climate change to kind of rally in those places and send us pictures. And there were several thousand of them in the course of that same day. And they showed what the real face of global warming was like. I mean, there were thousands of pictures. The first pictures of the day were people underwater diving on the coral reefs in the Marshall Islands in the Pacific, which, like all coral reefs, is dying away. People in Afghanistan dealing with drought, and in Pakistan dealing with flood, and, you know, on and on and on all over the world. Seeing that movement arise, seeing those people step up, you know, all the Pacific Island nations this year did their own Day of Action. We kind of helped coordinate where they called it Pacific Warrior Day of Action, and all these low-lying islands that may disappear this century. They rallied to say, we're not drowning, we're fighting. That was their slogan. And I guess if they can do that, then the rest of us can keep going in some way or another. No guarantees that we're going to win, but there is a guarantee, I think, now that the fight is underway, and I'm really happy about that.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us today. I'm sorry we couldn't get a little bit longer of a time, but I know you're busy and off to a talk.
I'll look forward to the next time, and thank you very much, Matt, for all your good work and everybody at BAI.
We will end today's show with another passage from Bill McKibben's new book, Oil and Honey. Man, it's a good thing climate change is a hoax, because by the time I got back to the States, you'd sure have thought there was something to this global warming stuff. For a hoax? It has excellent production values. Consider, it wasn't just the 2,132 new high temperature marks in June of 2012. It was what went with them. Duluth, Minnesota broke all its old rainfall records. And in an excellent cinematic touch, so much water flooded the city zoo that the seal escaped and swam down Grand Avenue. In the Gulf of Mexico, meanwhile, Tropical Storm Debbie became the earliest fourth storm of the season ever recorded, and then dumped, quote, unthinkable amounts of rain on central Florida. Giveaway movie moment. The 9-foot gator that washed into a Tampa swimming pool. Out west, the largest fire in New Mexico history torched more than 170,000 acres. And then the most destructive blaze in the annals of Colorado burned on the edge of Fort Collins. But that was just the warm-up. It was Colorado Springs in Waldo Canyon where the nation really got to see what a wildfire looks like. Tweets and blog posts recounted the specific terrors. One resident wrote a harrowing account of driving his SUV across suburban soccer fields to escape the blaze, with, quote, a vision of hell in my rearview mirror. It was cinematic in the extreme. The flames perfectly framed the famous chapel of the Air Force Academy on the very day the new cadets arrived. Another firestorm, near the Boulder campus of the National Center for Atmospheric Research, forced the evacuation of the planet's foremost climate scientists. I mean, come on. The record heat moved east from Colorado, as records that dated back to the Dust Bowl fell with uncanny speed. Images of a farmer kicking the dust in his drought-ridden field, that old Hollywood staple, reappeared on the evening news. The scene worked so well that the price of corn and wheat shot through the roof. At 115 degrees, Hill City, Kansas was the warmest spot on the continent, with farmers fainting in the field and workers burning themselves on tools left in the sun. The town is also home, cinematic touch, to a museum chronicling the history of the oil industry. An absurd number of catastrophes kept happening at the same time, just as in the best disaster flicks. On the last Friday of June, Washington set all-time heat records. One observer described it as like, quote, being in a giant wet mouth of a dog, except 6 degrees warmer. And then shortly after dinner, a storm for the ages blew through. First, there was 5 minutes of high wind blowing dust and debris, followed by an explosive display of thunder and lightning that left 4 million people without power. Which is to say, without air conditioning, just as the temperatures got even hotter. By the 1st of July, the newspapers had just about run out of adjectives. Stifling, oppressive, unbearable. The numbers were most telling. Atlanta, hottest temperature ever recorded. Ditto Raleigh. Ditto. The list was endless. In Goldsboro, North Carolina, the temperature was 103, and the humidity was 83%, which made for a heat index of 131 degrees. None of this, of course, did anything to slow down the fossil fuel machine. The White House chose that week, in fact, to announce that the final permits for the southern half of the Keystone Pipeline had been granted, that Shell could start drilling in the Arctic, and that it had auctioned off 700 million tons of Powder River Basin coal for the bargain price of $1.13 a ton. Nor did it humble the fossil fuel industry. Rex Tillerson of ExxonMobil told the New York audience that same day that Colorado Springs burned that global warming was, quote, an engineering problem with engineering solutions. Right. An engineering problem.
I could feel my desire to do some damage to the oil industry growing with every new weather report. We started signing contracts with booking agencies for the concert halls that would host our Do the Math tour.
If it's wrong to wreck the climate, it's wrong to profit from that wreckage.
2012 was the hottest year in the United States since scientists started keeping records.
My guest, Bill McKibben,
our nation's leading environmentalist.
We're building the kind of political movement that will change things.
As of tonight, we're taking on the fossil fuel industry directly. These companies are a rogue force.
We're no longer at the point of trying to stop global warming. Too late for that. We're trying to keep it from becoming a complete and utter calamity.
Carbon in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million is not compatible with life on Earth. That's strong language for scientists to use. Today, the atmosphere is 395 parts per million.
The fossil fuel industry has five times more coal and oil and gas, and it's safe to burn.
They are locking us into a future that we can't survive.
This is the biggest emergency the human family has faced since it came out of the caves.
We are at a tipping point in America's history.
If they carry out their business plan, the planet tanks.
Tar sands are the turning point in our fossil fuel addiction.
I say it's criminal, and I say that not lightly.
We subsidize the fossil fuel industries.
And that is just financially and morally bankrupt.
We have to send a message that we are going to hold them liable.
We have a moral catastrophe on our hands.
What's at stake now is civilization itself.
This is the only question that will matter in the long run.
The movie, Do the Math, is going to be broadcast to millions of homes across the United States on Al Jazeera America on September 22nd. Bill McKibben will be in the New York area on Wednesday, September 18th at the Powerhouse Arena in Brooklyn. It'll be starting at 7 p.m., and for more information, please call 718-666-3049. And be sure to check out his new book, Oil and Honey, coming out on Tuesday, September 17th. If you missed any part of today's show or would like to share it with friends, visit our website at equaltimeforfreethought.org. And remember to tune in, pay it forward, and question everything.